Well, it's Friday once again after a very, very busy week. So time once again for DC Signal to Noise. I'm John Harris, along with Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk and Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmers Policy Analyst. And I guess this week, since we've been talking about it the last three, we might as well start again with CFAP. Jim, we got the details this week, but were they really helpful?
They were confusing at first, and there were a couple of reasons for that.
I think Annalisa is still confused.
One is that Congress made it complex because they really didn't give USDA the flexibility relative to Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act funding, CCC. So then they had to kind of divide these payments between the CARES Act and CCC. That was one major complexity. So I don't blame USDA for that.
Well, that was put on them by Congress because of the funding that Congress gave them. Yeah.
Yes. But USDA added to the confusion with some of the material they put out. Their press release was not nearly as specific that it should have been. They eventually, you had to find it, they had a video showing you a calculator that still is not available, but it was on the video. It's going to be made available the date the signup begins. But that cleared a lot of stuff up. And then when I think they should have emphasized the questions and answers, and even some of those were modified as the week went on, and probably a few more will. That taught me again to always go to the actual rule. Because when you go to the rule, that doesn't solve everything, but it clarifies someone who has tried to simplify or tried to summarize the rule, and that's where you get into problems.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't get why they didn't put out that calculator this week when they announced the rule, because that would have solved so many questions. Because, I mean, that is the question everybody has, is how much money I'm going to get. The rest is just semantics. The real answer they want is, what's the check going to be?
I agree. And you wouldn't have had to worry about the calculations and what about this. It would have plugged it right in for you. And still today, they really should have the calculator out. Mm-hmm. Now, I know one enterprising from a consulting firm, Combest Cell, worked out one himself, you know. So, I mean, that's a shame that USDA did not make that available right away, because it helps understand when you go through the spreadsheets.
Do we know
this level of disconcertation or lack of organization is not new, really, for new USDA programs? I mean, this is what we've seen in the past, isn't it, Jim?
Yeah, but they really, in my copy earlier this week, I gave them an F for communications because they bollocksed it at the beginning because it raised more questions than it answered. I mean, it's not like they didn't have time. I mean, this thing was April 17th is when, this thing was cleared. So they had over a month to lay an egg, and they did.
And one of my frustrations is always that they don't brief their county people before they release it to the media, because then farmers call county offices and county office folks are like, I'm sorry, I don't know.
That's
super frustrating.
I talked to a couple of former SEDs at FSA office, and they're doing the planning, sessions, and questions have already been raised at the planning sessions for at the FSA offices, especially regarding forward contracting, not dairy, but in the grains. And I had a pretty good contact say that's still an open question.
No,
but
really?
Boy, I don't know. I don't think it is myself. I just think there's a lot of disgruntled farmers who are saying, wait a minute, if I forward contracted, you mean you're going to penalize me for proper marketing on it? However, the rule clearly says you have to have risk. And if you forward contract, where's the risk? So I can understand basis contracts because you still have the pricing to do. So I think that should be eligible, but they don't really say that. So these are the things that have to be worked out. But I will tell you, a number of county FSA and state executive directors have raised some issues. So we could still, see some changes early next week.
And you have to be sympathetic to that position of the guys that said, hey, I did everything right. I've done everything I can to protect myself, and now I'm being punished for it.
1,000%.
Agree. And then there was the nuance that, again, I'm just talking crops or non-specialty crops, as they call them now. But I just like to say corn, soybeans, you know, the regular program crop. But it's based on inventory as of January the 15th, and immediately that raised, because I'm used to these things, it's not limited to 2019 crop. That means you could have 2018, 2017. However, you have to take the lower of your inventory or no more than 50% of 2019 production. So the maximum eligible is 50% of 2019 production. There's a different way to write it.
Yeah.
So that's a maximum. However, say you didn't have any 2019 crop and you just had old crop, 2018, 2017, that would still be eligible up to 50% of 2019 production.
Yeah. So again, the guys that have been waiting for that bump that never came are getting rewarded for it. Does crop still standing in the field in the Dakotas count as in inventory on January 15th?
That would be 2019.
Yeah.
You'd have to prove production. It's a good question.
Well, I mean,
it's
not
production yet.
There's not an insignificant amount that was still standing in field.
Especially North Dakota.
Yeah.
Yes, I hear you.
All right. So given all this and what we've seen in the last 2 weeks from USDA on this program, what is your level of confidence that we will indeed see checks the week after next?
Pretty good.
Really?
Remember last show, I thought that they could turn it around, and they did. Once USDA has the parameters down, it's like a spring training. They know what to do. They just got to limber up a little bit. Okay. and the calculations on the checks, they're used to that in Kansas City, you know, to get them out.
And they clarified too I think it was on the press call I was with Undersecretary Northey that, once a producer has turned in all of the paperwork, so the application plus any other additional documentation, then they will process that paperwork, and they're giving a 60-day timeline from the time that you turn in your complete application. So, I mean, I think it will be quicker than that for people who get those applications submitted Tuesday when the program opens.
Yes.
But I think that because it's going to be a large volume, I think that there will be some backlog for sure.
Yeah, I know most of the people up here say by the time your application is accepted, okay, 7 to 10 days after that, the funding, you know, will show up in your bank account. I guess that's what the way it usually happens. So that's a tried and true system. Now, I know for some specialty crops and things, there could be some more time lag because that's probably from the producer end. They're just not used to going in to the office or filling out the forms for this. So, I think to be fair to USDA on that, I understand that. But initially when you read it, it was very complex. I mean, I won't mention his name, but I had a top economist email me that night to say, it's almost verbatim, I have a PhD and I'm still having problems figuring this out.
And he said, well, so are the people that wrote it.
Yeah. Once he saw the video, it cleared it up.
Well,
it cleared it up. So wouldn't you think they would have known? See, I fault communications people at USDA, and I think that's a problem of they just haven't been there very long. And frankly, I'm seeing this in government.
Yes.
Right now, you two. I'm seeing it at the Office Management and Budget, where you have a relatively new staffers in agriculture who really don't know farm programs the way they should to even ask questions, right? I'm seeing at the Congressional Budget Office that scores all these programs. I'm not saying they don't know what they're doing, but they don't have the experience. And remember, I said that because that's increasingly going to come into play in the years ahead as we shift from very long time, very good career people at USDA, OMB, and CBO to the newer people. That's going to take time to learn these very complex programs.
Yeah, indeed. And yeah, we've seen a lot of turnover in that, not only the USDA Communications Department, but across government, and not even just agriculture, but just across government in general. That is, you're losing that institutional knowledge when you do that.
Yes. And as long as you have a Bill Northey, you know, to bring up his name again, if he's in the skullduggery sessions going into this thing, he would be able to raise market questions or farmer questions relative to what about basis contracts or deferred pricing or forward contracting? And how do we answer a clear farmer expectation of you're rewarding poor marketing?
Right.
You know?
Right.
What about 2020 crop? And I know Bill Northey talked about that on AgriTalk earlier this week. They're going to handle 2020 later. They even admitted that because of Sonny Perdue, Ag Secretary, and others at USDA, their fixation that they don't want to skew plantings.
Well, so also the limited CCC funding they have.
Program. I'm sorry?
But also the limited CCC funding they have at this moment is holding them back quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely. They it would have been watered down. They knew that. So that's going to be, and that bridges us. I mean, you know, we can keep talking on the CFAP, but now it's got to be implemented. But it's what's not in CFAP that's just as important. No indemnity funds. Some crops, like certain varieties of wheat, are hollering that they were not included with the price calculation, and they've gone into USDA and saying, look, we show on this particular class of wheat a 10% cut, and I think, what was the cut, 5%? You had to have a 5%, you know, reduction in price. Potatoes just are railing. Certain egg product producers, I think, and I think some of these are going to be changed. As a result of evidence coming into USDA, and that's the way it should be.
Well, and the president voiced a willingness to do that in the White House, in the Oval Office announcement this week on this, said that anybody that wasn't included probably will be soon. So there's certainly an openness to that in the administration.
Yes.
We spent a lot of time talking about the caps, payment caps that were in the original announcement. The original caps were $125,000 per commodity, $250,000 total per owner. That was changed so that they eliminated the $125,000 per commodity. So it's just a straightforward $250,000 payment cap per owner. Annalisa, does this satisfy the concerns of your dairymen?
You know, I think it does in a lot of ways, John, but I think what's more important that was also included is, and it's non-traditional for USDA, but to allow corporations, LLCs, and some limited partnerships to have a higher cap. So it's $250,000 per eligible shareholder.
750,000. But Texas A&M... I want to give a shout out to Texas A&M, the Ag Policy Center there, Dr. Joe Outlaw, Bart Fisher, who used to be the chief economist on the House Ag Committee when they wrote the 2018 Farm Bill. Within a day after this was announced, they had a monograph out on this program. I mean, that's unheard of at a land-grant university, I'm telling you. And they did a really good job. And in there, we put a link to it on ProFarmer.com. So I would, listeners call it up because they analyzed too. And on the dairy, they just said, you know, with the average dairy producer at X number of cows, they're going to hit that payment cap pretty quickly. So this is why lawmakers don't like payment caps when you have the need for an ad hoc disaster program, not just a disaster, a price disaster or a pandemic. So I still look for a real big push in this phase four of the aid bill for lawmakers to still push to say no payment cap. Now, what would that mean? In USDA's cost-benefit analysis, which is always a good thing to always read some of these things. On page 20, it's got, what if you didn't have a payment cap by commodity? All crops, all specialty crops, okay, or all crops, it would have meant $3 billion more dollars had
Holy
there not
smokes.
Been a payment cap. So that's liquidity there. And then they have it by crop. Obviously corn, because the number of bushels and things like that would be pretty large. But even on the dairy sector, you don't, if you're a typical dairy producer with any size, you're going to hit that cap fairly quickly.
Well, and speaking of hitting caps, USDA in their announcement this week said that they're going to pay out 80% of a maximum payment. So actually the cap is less than $250,000, at least in the first round of payments. They're reserving 20% in case they run out of funding, so they could revisit later on. How quickly do we hit that 80% of $16 billion? Or how quickly do we hit $16 billion with those 80% payments?
Well, they're saying sometime the 20% payment will be paid in the summer or the fall. That's what usually they tell you.
If they can get funding.
Oh, they'll get funding. There's not many things I'm sure of, but this thing's going to be funded. I understand why USDA did what they did. Sorry, because there's other payments they have to make, CRP payments, other payments that come out of the CCC Charter Act. So that's why it was $6.5 billion, even though they had a little more in the CCC Charter Act. And so I totally understand why they did it, but lawmakers are going to do several things in this phase four that'll happen sometime in the month of June, because the Senate's out until June 1. So I would figure the middle of the month or maybe a little later in June.
Well, what's the deadline? That'll tell you when it gets done. What's the next deadline they face to go ahead out of town?
That's true. Well, July 4th when they go out for the recess too. There you go. But they're going to put more money, replenish CCC probably again. So that'll take care of that 20% if they're even close to it. And hopefully they will. Well, USDA has $14 billion at the end of June. So July, okay, that they can't touch right now. For an accounting reason. I mean, they should change that too. But then I think the move is going to be in Congress to give what USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue and Senator John Hovind, Republican from North Dakota, initially wanted to change the cap on CCC borrowing authority from the current $30 billion to $50 billion or more. To get that, however, I know Colin Peterson, House Ag Committee Chairman, Democrat from Minnesota, is going to want some stipulations on that amount of funding, and I don't blame him.
He doesn't want some authority.
Yeah,
he doesn't want the USDA Secretary to have a free rein piggy bank sitting there.
And
no matter what party
him.
It is, yeah.
I don't blame him. And also the Democrats are going to want to get some other things that they want, especially a rather large increase, at least 15% in the SNAP or food stamp, funding. So I think that there's some leverage at play there. But bottom line, that for producers who are listening, it's going to be fully funded within the concept of CFAP. Make sure of that.
And some change in the CCC charter language to allow for, or some legislative motion to allow for payment for depopulation of the herd because of coronavirus.
Absolutely. Again, these are things that pretty good people tell me they could probably really do in the CCC Charter Act, but USDA wants a clear authorization and language of that. And also for the biofuels, I think you'll see a biofuel type of program funded via the CCC. Now, we keep on mentioning CCC. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. There's our concept that we talked about last year that gives them, I keep on saying it's like a Federal Reserve of Ag, like an ag reserve. It gives them more flexibility. And I think anybody should want that with stipulations, because you never just want an executive branch, in this case, USDA, to have too much control because of the oversight that the House and Senate Agriculture Committee have. So it can be a joint. And I think you're looking at the beginnings of a new farm bill approach so you don't have to come back every so many years, that if something raises up like this pandemic, and it may not be the first one, you've got the flexibility built in. For example, what if, I know we're bridging some other issues here, but what if China does the worst in, you know, in Hong Kong? Ooh, that's going to be a major event if they do, because that puts pressure on Western allies, not just the U.S. What is their response? And then it's the tit for tat, because if China is signaling they're going to tilt toward the more military side, which I think they are, as opposed to the economic side, if you know, go back to what a communist historically do, the, you know, militaristic, then we're going to have some bumpy, you know, hurdles again. And that's why you need this flexibility within the funding mechanism to deal with some of these things potentially that could come about. I hope they never have to tap CCC to the degree that they have been, but thank goodness it's there.
Since you took us there, Jim, let's move to China. And maybe you could explain this to me. I don't understand what the payoff is with China fully taking over Hong Kong that warrants the risk of alienating the rest of the world against them in taking a military action, or at least a strong police action against the citizens of Hong Kong.
Well, Xi has his internal pressures there, too, as a result of the COVID-19. They're turning even more nationalistic than they were before. And they're seeing, at least these are what China watchers are telling me. They're seeing this now growing louder drumbeat from the U.S., Australia, and some other nations saying, we want an inquiry regarding the startup of this COVID-19. And that means getting into the Chinese labs. Well, won't happen. So they're probably thinking, okay, we've lost a lot of goodwill here in the world here. So they're citing what their history shows more on under the control, on the control side and the militaristic side. I hope I'm wrong on that, but history shows that that's what they usually do.
If they're headed that way, do you think there's a likely chance that they will step up purchases under phase one to try to distract the U.S. politics away from what they're doing in Hong Kong?
Yes.
Well,
if
quick.
You see, if yes, if you saw, I've been thinking through these things. If you see, I remember the old Soviet Union days, remember the Great American Grain Robbery and all that, where there were 1 to 2 million metric tons of corn purchases in days.
Yeah.
Okay. If you start seeing million ton purchases, okay, remember I said that that's a good thing. And it's also a potential signal. Yeah. Okay. Because then just think about it. If they have millions of tons on the books, okay. And something,
but not yet on the boats,
not get on the boats.
Yeah.
This is like the Carter grain embargo all over again.
Oh, don't
because
say that.
The grain, I'll never forget it. The grain companies came into town. Their CEOs, they said, you know, we've got exposure here. And yeah. That's when they took over the grain. They had the payments, et cetera. So it can happen. I'm not predicting it will happen, but be ready in case it does. And those are some of the things that I'll look towards. Because they figured the timing, China, a communist nation, is always looks for timing. So the amount of tension that countries are having to spend on COVID-19, from the funding mechanism, the healthcare systems, getting people back to work, that's a clear diversionary time for China to do some of the things that they're doing. I mean, look what they're doing in the Congress. Now, in their big Congress confab, yeah. For the first time since, what, 1994, they didn't release a gross domestic product estimate. They know what's coming there.
Oh, yeah, they don't want to put out bad news.
They don't want to, and some of them, some people are saying it could be as low, like 1.5%. They don't want that out.
Yeah,
so
indeed.
They're just not going to publish it. But they did announce another increase in their defense expenditures. So they are clearly sending signals, John. They're sending signals that gives longtime China watchers the heebie-jeebies, okay?
And Annalisa, farmers and ranchers have got to be getting whiplash watching the back and forth about China over the last couple of weeks. And we've had the stuff that Jim's been talking about and the ramping up of military and the saber rattling between Trump and Xi. But at the same time, you've got Larry Kudlow and Robert Lighthizer and Secretary Perdue all saying, oh, phase one is moving right along. Everything's good. Nothing to see here.
Yeah, I think it's classic. You know, we've seen this from the beginning of this trade war, where members of the White House are not saying the same thing, and that causes confusion. And farmers just would like to know either way. I mean, they're obviously holding their breath that phase one does get implemented and that China does come through with purchases, which we're starting to see them purchase more. But it's frustrating, right, when you see leaders in government not saying the same thing.
Well, whenever you have a managed agreement, you get these possibilities, and that's what it is. It's a managed trade agreement, and it's usually messy, and we're seeing, you know, that's the case. But we'll know a lot more in the next few months, because not only with the Hong Kong situation, but also basically Brazil is sold out, and also some China people are telling me they're getting nervous about COVID-19 in Brazil. So they're worried about long-term supply availability of products from Brazil. So that's another fly in the potential price rise ointment here, that we could see some pretty hefty purchases. Plus, China, as we've talked about before, if they're truly building up their hog sector in the future, they're going to go a rather dramatic way from prior to the African swine fever, up to 50% of the feed for hogs was garbage. Yeah. And now they want to go to more of a traditional hog ration. Well, that means purchases both domestically and internationally of soybeans to crush for meal, and also corn. And so that bodes well for the future of potential U.S.-China trade in the grains area, if the overall relations are okay. There's caveats all over the place because the signals are very murky right now. Here's another one I want to point out before I forget it. President Trump is trying to get a G7 meeting in person at Camp David. Now, this is an interesting time. You always got to be interesting in time, because on AgriTalk today, there was a question of, well, if something happened in Hong Kong, would Trump work with our allies? Well, this would be pretty heady stuff that I think his advisors, and I think he would listen to his advisors here, saying, you know, you've got to have a coordinated ally response. So I think if they do meet, either like we're meeting or in person, I actually hope it's in person because I think you can do more, that I think this would be on the list of agenda of if then of what they would do.
Yeah. And I'm going to give my pitch to the president's advisors here and give them my free advice. And if they can present it to the president, not as we need to seek a global consensus on this, but rather if you bring in Great Britain, if you bring in France, if you bring in Germany, that only amplifies the leverage that you have against China. It is a tool you can use to put maximum pressure on the Chinese.
China listens to strength. And they would listen to it, whether back off, I don't know, but they would definitely listen more than just if President Trump went solo again.
Well, and again, I think the president would be more interested in something that brings him leverage rather than something that's seeking the blessing of the world community.
I agree. You know, this morning I had a little nugget of thing, and we put it in Pro Farmer too. A couple China watchers have been talking to me this week, and they're saying, you know, what if? And you got to be prepared for these things all the time from a policy perspective. What if a month or so before the presidential election, Trump internally, he would never say it publicly, if he internally thinks he's going to lose the election, what does Trump do relative to U.S.-China relations in that vanguard? Some of the China watchers are telling me that he would get very aggressive with them because that's his claim as he leaves office, right, that he was not just tough, very tough on China. So that's another potential black swan that you have to watch out for. You have to go contingencies nowadays and look in the ag sector. We have to.
Yeah.
Because we're confronted. We're a global market. Now we see why these things are so important.
Jim, we've talked about these two compete. Well, actually, we've gotten to about a dozen competing messages on China, but there's two main competing ones, and that is phase one is good, things are moving forward. The other is we've got this ramp up of tensions. Is this one of those rare incidences where both of those are signal?
They are. And we'll have to see the pitch, you know?
we don't know what's behind the glove yet.
Yeah, I will say, I think the phase one is a pretty good agreement if China follows through. Now, there are reasons why. They haven't asked for an extension yet, and Larry Kudlow said that, I guess it was yesterday. Again, I think there will eventually be, if we get there, they'll call it something else, but I think it'll be the first year might be 15 months, you know, time frame, as opposed to 12.
Yeah.
Okay, so be it. So be it. And that gets you into the normal pattern anyway. It goes through March next year. And they typically buy, 70% of the tonnage they typically buy from the U.S. is in the October through March timeframe. So that shouldn't be a problem to us, you know, because it is too soon to point to their numbers and saying, oh, woe is me. They're not going to live up to it. Not when they're just going into the summer, fall quarters where they typically buy U.S. farm products because of the price, because of their storage reserve needs, both domestic and strategic needs, because they've whittled down their strategic reserves. So that's why if you're going to be surprised at corn purchases, it's a combination of reasons, not only the hog sector, but for strategic reserves.
All right. Should we finish up today talking about President Trump going more than a bit off script at his White House event this week, announcing CFAP?
It's what you call the Trump moment, right? Thinking out loud. And really, it's the populist in him. It's a big nerve in his body to say, stop things coming in.
It made our calf happy.
It did. But the National Cattlemen's Beef Association person was there, and you could just see wincing and all that. And then he brought up the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, and most, if not all, of the imports come from Mexico and Canada. I don't think you'll hear him talk about that much. There's no follow-through there, okay? It's just one of those Trump-isms, okay?
Yeah, it was fun reading NCBA's press release after that of trying to voice support for the president and the support he thought he was voicing for cattlemen, but at the same time saying, this is really a lot more complicated than it may appear on the surface.
Absolutely. And I told a White House person who called me afterwards saying, well, what do you think? Well, of course, I went on the cattle thing. But I said, you know, the president missed, and I don't think it was his fault. I think it's his advisors. President Trump missed a good opportunity to tell 2020 crop producers that help will be on the way.
Yeah.
And why would you leave that off the table? It's just politically, it just didn't make sense to me. So you wonder the strategy sessions. If you're going to have a White House event, what they did, make the most of it. And again, why was he not a talking point told that? Because Trump loves to spend money.
Yeah, that's a perfect opportunity to say, hey, this is the down payment. There's going to be more. Plus, we've got phase one that's really going to start rolling later half of this year. Isn't this all great for my farmers?
Yes. And I think had he been told that, he would have said it. I would have whispered it in his ear and he would have shouted it out, you know. But he was not told that. So again,
he wasn't told that. He may have been told that and what came out was cattle.
And
or potato varieties. I mean, he was all over the place.
Yeah.
Yes. He won potatoes. I mean, it just was a kind of an odd. I looked at the transcript again. I go, oh my gosh, is just...
I said something to my husband, and he goes, are you surprised he's a verbal processor? Like, he is a... even when he shouldn't be, he is a verbal processor. And I'm like, that's true.
Well, to say another example of this, at another confab at the White House with the Restaurant Association people, restaurant CEOs, he brought up a particular nuance of butter that you can get in New England. And they were shocked that he even knew of that, but he loved it. And they spent some time regarding that. And you just think, oh, my goodness.
But sometimes that works to his advantage, because it's one of those things that... It's a little thing that you can pick up and focus in on that says, hey, I know you. Now, you've got to be able to follow through on that effectively. And I don't know that the NRA one was that effective. It came off more as a weird aside. But
yeah,
it is a tool in his arsenal that he can use effectively sometimes.
It is. You know, I get a little more background story. A New York Times reporter called me up earlier this week, and she had some questions relative to the payment caps and things like that on the program. She was getting ready to write her story. And then she asked me about Trump's approval rating in farm country. And I know you got involved with that, with a potential update to the Pulse, you know, Farm Journal Pulse survey, because they're really interested in that. But she asked me, she goes, well, do you think he's going to hold the farmers' support now with this COVID-19 and the price drop and having to kill all these animals? And I told her, I said, I could only tell you what anecdotally, but when I could go out and give a lot of speeches, what more than a few farmers and ranchers told me. One, they like Trump because he's not a politician. He's not really a politician normally. Two is they talk like him. Farmers talk like Trump. And three, he talks about agriculture more than any president in their lifetime. And those are all true.
They are.
So and I don't see the pushback. Him. I'm sorry?
I said they feel seen by him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's important.
I agree. And they know he's battling, and it's also their growing animosity, not just farmers, but a growing number of people, their animosity toward Washington because of the fisticuffs, both political parties. I mean, Trump, wearing a mask or not wearing a mask, they fixate on things to such a degree. When Trump was in Michigan yesterday, when he toured a certain facility, he put it on and he said publicly, I didn't want to put it on generally because I didn't want to give the press the pleasure. So he tweaks them. He knows it's going to get them. That's just the type of person he is. Just, it is what it is.
And it distracts them into something he sees as harmless and kind of he enjoys getting at their goat and puts their attention over there and not over here, whatever else they might be covering.
Yes. I mean, I don't know who watches network news anymore. You talk about a waste of time. And CNN, I'm just, if I want to be shocked like a horror show, I watch CNN to tell you the truth. I mean, it's just horrible, oh my God, And then it gets you Debbie Downer because they just go years that we're going to be faced with this coming back. I just say, I don't need that. I want to go outside. I want to see my irises, I don't ever want to turn on that program again because it's so down. Charlie Cook has a column, Charlie Cook, the political expert. Yeah. He has a column today where he says, Republicans have their problem coming up in the election, but so do Democrats. And they better watch the line where they don't want it to seem that voters are thinking the Democrats want it to be bad. They don't want to bring people back to work. They don't want the prices to go up. They don't want the stock market to rally. And I think they're getting close to, getting to that structure when you hear some of the governors of Democratic-controlled states. I mean, it looks like they just want to throw away the key until the day after the election. And that's not good.
Yeah, I think whoever's able to craft a compelling message of cautious, and underscore cautious, hope through the end of this year. I think that's going to be the winning message, but neither side's been able to do that yet. You've got, I think on the Trump side, just run back at the economy at all costs. And then the Democrats, the absolute opposite of that. And I think the successful strategy is threading the needle somewhere in between those two.
I agree. And but again, what Trump said initially, the cure could be worse than the disease. We're starting to see some elements of that signal that he had, what, a month ago when he started talking about that, with the mental health problems that we've seen, abuse in homes and things like that, children. Can you imagine the children having to be forced into this just horrible situation of not being able to go out? And I don't know what they do anymore, but
I've got two that are attached to an Xbox that don't seem to mind it a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah.
Although but they do miss school and seeing their friends.
Well, the college kids that I know and I like to keep in the loop, they couldn't graduate, you know, the way they wanted to. And that gets you down. And internships, how many internships were canceled as a result of this? And you know, that gets into your psyche of where will it always be that way, et cetera. I'm starting to hear that from younger people. So just it's time to take a calculated, like you said, calculated risk. Now, I'm in the dangerous category, so I have to be more careful.
In many ways, Jim.
But I can see other people saying, okay, come on, take precautions, but let's start, doing some things. And you're seeing it in the gasoline consumption.
Mm-hmm. People are doing it anyways.
They're starting it. Yes.
So if we could do some controlled, again, it's not an all or nothing proposition here. You can take baby steps towards opening up, see where you get, and when you get to a point where you need to draw back, then draw back.
I agree.
So,
and there are short term, you know, when you're a speaker like I am, you're decimated as far as going out and speaking, you know, and I love eye contact, but now we're going to improve the video we're on now. We're gonna improve those. We're gonna improve on that. We're gonna have different ways where we may have 15 minute at a time speakers as opposed to 45 minutes because you know people. It's been proven on webinars you don't speak too long at one time. You know, yeah. I'm starting to bone up on things like that and are on conference calls as a result of this, some aspects of that. So those are the things in the our industry, communications, that we're learning and I don't think are going to go away. I don't think that's going to go away because we're seeing some advantages. Of course, there's disadvantages, but some advantages are we can be more flexible. We can have a series of people, experts, where you don't have to wait and worry if they're going to show up to a meeting in Phoenix, Arizona. You know, yeah. So the signals I'm getting is, okay, you learn from these hard times. And I think from a communications end, you know, that's going to dramatically change our industry for the future.
Yeah, a lot of these changes are going to be here to stay, or at least in some modified version. All right, Jim, yeah. I don't want to hold you back from those lilies in your white wine any longer, all right? So we'll wrap up the way we always do. Well, I guess I'm not holding you back from anything.
Whiskey.
Just a lily, sorry.
I didn't drink it.
Yet. Just getting that ice cube fully marinated.
What we're watching for
inside.
Next week is yes. USDA's rollout of the sign-up. Two is more Q&As, whether or not, what, if any, they're going to modify and get those out. And three, China, Hong Kong, China trade agreement, et cetera. Those are my tasks for the week ahead.
All right, Annalisa.
Same. I mean, watching what happens with the rollout of CFAP, and there's still a lot of unanswered questions in the dairy space relative to, like, Holstein steers and things, you know, other components beyond milk that are on dairy farms. So I'm interested to see how that rolls out. And then also just like Jim mentioned earlier, just the sign up process and the smoothness of that. We're also going to see producers who have never signed up for a program before mm-hmm. sign up for this one. So that'll be interesting.
With an agency that hasn't handled this kind of sign up before.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel for USDA in that regard and the Ag Marketing Service, but they're going to learn as well as we are that you have to be clear in your message. and bend over backwards to be farmer friendly on any farm program. I've learned that many decades ago. If in doubt, be pro farmer.
There you go. Hey, Alex, are you going to be interacting with FSA this week?
Monday or Tuesday when they open, yeah.
Okay, you willing to share what you learned there?
Sure,
what
absolutely.
The experience is like, yeah, let's
We're
talk about that next week.
Because dairy goats and dairy sheep never qualify for a program, but we do qualify under the livestock sector of CFAP. So this will be the first time we've qualified for an aid program ever. So it'll be fun.
All right, interesting. All right. Well, thanks to you both, and thanks for this trying this little video experiment that Jim wasn't supposed to talk about. So we'll let the cat out of the bag. Maybe you'll be seeing our glorious faces here in the near future. Thanks to you both. Okay. That wraps up this week's edition of DC Signal to Noise.